This is an interview with Jeffrey Williamson, formerly of the UW Economics Department, now at Harvard. We're talking in his office in the Litauer Center. I'm Laura Smale, doing the interview for the UW Archives Oral History Project, and this is the 18th of November, 1985.
Sure. Do I in fact press this little button?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Why don't you just talk about your background a little bit, why you went into economics and why you came to the UW?
Sure. I was a faculty brat. I grew up at Wesleyan University, where my dad was an economist. I avoided economics. I went to Wesleyan and avoided economics, since he was still on the staff there, until my senior year as an undergraduate, at which point I thought it was safe to take economics and not be captured by it, and was as a result captured by it. I was a mathematics major and an art minor, so I had interest in the humanities to begin with.
Was he an art minor?
Yes. Yeah. I was, as you can see on my wall here, still maintain the interest. But went to graduate school at Stanford in 1957. Was a graduate student there for 4 years. My main areas of interest were in economic development and international trade. And when it came time to write a thesis, I was advised by Moses Abramovitz, past president of the American Economic Association, that if I was interested in development, I might look at a country which was already developed and see how it got there. And so I did. I wrote my thesis on aspects of 19th century U.S. development, basically balance of payments problems. So that thesis was my first exposure to economic history. Now that is 1961. I leave Stanford with my PhD. My first appointment was at Vanderbilt in Nashville, where I taught for 2 years.
Jobs were already easy to get?
Right at that time, there was just the beginnings of the enormous increase, which then accelerated across the 60s in job openings in academia. And I can remember the salary I received was $6,500, which my father thought was outrageous, since he was close to retirement at $10,000, which seems to me pretty outrageous now. But anyway, I went to Vanderbilt and found that the demand for young economists was very strong and growing like mad. And one manifestation of it was that Wisconsin was interested in hiring and increasing its staff and hiring young people. And one of the areas they wanted to hire in was in economic history, especially those who had interest in the new quantitative methods and theoretical approaches to economic history. I am not even sure I was aware I was one of those at the time, but they were. And so, in fact, I left Vanderbilt and went to Wisconsin in 1963.
All right, be a little more specific about that. Who got in touch with you and who talked to you about it?
Let's see. I think it was Jim Early who is... I'm certain he was the chairman at that time. And Jim is now in the UC system, I think, still, isn't he? But he was the chairman at that critical time and played a critical role in recruiting the first generation of new people in the economics department. And he adopted a very expansionist strategy and hired one heck of a lot of people. So my cohort that came in was a very large one. It included people like Glenn Kane, Ed Foggy, and others who were coming in at that stage.
What was the inducement to come here? There,
right. Wisconsin had had lots of things going for it. One is they paid more, but mostly I had just, I guess, after spending a year at Vanderbilt, realized that teaching was fun, but that I wanted to do more research. And I found it difficult in that environment, but had no reason to believe that it was any different anywhere else for an assistant professor at that time. Until I went to visit in January, I do recall quite clearly, January of 1983, Wisconsin, where I gave a workshop, 63, of course, where I gave the workshop, and they looked at my skills, and I looked at their attributes, and we married. But going there at that time, I realized the difference in just intellectual excitement of the place compared to Vanderbilt, and that attracted me right at the start.
Well, what was the source of intellectual excitement? I mean, I don't think it was Jim Early.
No, but it was simply two things. One is circulating through the department and talking to individuals, and the kinds of questions they would ask, which dealt almost entirely with professional issues, dealt with the kinds of research I was dealing with and the kinds of research they were dealing with, whereas at Vanderbilt, so much of the conversation was social conversation. And you sense that immediately. And then in the workshop itself, where department members listened to me tell them about work I was doing at that time, it became clear to me in terms of the debate that the quality of the questions were far superior than to any I had heard at Vanderbilt. And so generally the intellectual environment I concluded was a hell of a lot more exciting than the one prevailing at Vanderbilt.
George Orr had come in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
Steiner.
Yeah.
Was Orchid's program of any interest to you, or what they were doing generally?
Well, as it turns out, no. I'm trying to remember Orchid's first name now. It's not
George.
No. That's funny. It'll occur to me later. But anyway, Orchid was running
Guy.
Guy Orchid, right. Guy Orchid had gotten all these funds, I believe it was NSF funding, to do this grand, was it Ford Foundation? To do this grand microanalytic simulation model of the American economy. And in fact, at one point, he asked whether I'd be interested in working on the external parts of that model, that is, the foreign trade aspects. And I declined. Primarily because my interests were more in the Third World and more economic history rather than on the U.S. economy circa 1963. But it was certainly a dominant program at that time, which involved a good share of the human resources in the department, one-fifth, perhaps, of the people in the department were one way or another engaged in that research. And it was quite clear that that was the large collaborative effort that was ongoing at that time, though there were others as well. But I did not get involved in that program. What Wisconsin was looking for at that time was someone to help them teach the new economic history, which was just starting its meteoric rise throughout economics and economic history. 1959 or 1960 was a watershed in economic history, in the sense that it was the start of the explicit introduction of quantitative method and theory to economic history, and it was a very, very exciting time as a result, and throughout the 60s, and indeed still is today. And I was captured by that, and as a result, found myself sucked in to join the parade and to do similar kinds of research, first on the American economy at that time. And so I was more involved in that research program and teaching in that area than working with ORCOT in the more contemporary modeling.
I guess what I was wondering was when you decided to come, was there, were they intellectually stimulating to you, or were they too far removed from what you were interested in?
That project itself was not of interest to me, except generally. But the people who were working on that project were. That is, there was a collection of econometricians that were directly or indirectly part of that project. Arthur Goldberger, a young man who had been a peer of mine at Stanford, John Kamena, who became a well-known econometrician now at Ann Arbor. But he was at Wisconsin with me at that time. There was a group of econometricians, Arnold Zellner and others, that were part of the Goldberger-Zellner group that were interested in doing all kinds of helping people do all kinds of applied research. And that I found extremely attractive, to go to those people with my problems and to get educated in modern econometric method. That I found exciting. So that was an important resource for me, which didn't exist at Vanderbilt. And indeed, it ended up with some collaboration with some of the people like John Kamena in that area. So that was, it was just the sheer size of Wisconsin. And it's the menu that it had to offer just far exceeded what Vanderbilt could possibly offer, just a far more exciting and diverse intellectual environment in economics and outside of economics. I haven't said anything about the history department and its attraction. That really came a bit later. At that time, Rondo Cameron was instrumental in developing an economic history program which linked history and economics. Morton Rothstein was involved, Eric Lampard was involved, and we met as a workshop and taught jointly seminars, but I was really unaware of how my commitment would become more extensive and how
commitment
to the economic history group and to the economic history program would develop and mature so that I would become much more involved in it, because at this time I was still thinking both of economic history as an area of interest, but even more so economic development. And that had been my interest at Stanford. Most of my training under Hollis Chenery and others had been in economic development, that is, third world industrial revolutions. And that I still felt to be my strongest interest. And so I was able at Wisconsin to teach and to research in economic development simultaneously with economic history. And it was both things that attracted me there. And it was only through time that I found myself being pulled more and more into the economic history group.
So the economics department frowned on Everett Hawkins' kind of interests in the underdeveloped world, but they didn't object to research on developing countries. Is that right?
Well, you can't. It's awfully hard to ignore important problems. Even economists find that hard. Both economic history and economic development are applied fields that, though they have undergone enormous changes in degree of high tech, they are still backward sisters in the social science, or at least in economics. That's the nature of the disciplines. The questions are much broader. It's far more empirical. It requires knowledge and attention to more than simply macro or microeconomic theory. And as a result, the kinds of research that's done is less precise and less modeling than the core of economics, and that's appreciated now, and that was appreciated then. The reason why those two areas were tolerated then and are tolerated now is A, the third world is much too big and important to ignore. And as a result, every department needs economists, even if they're, quote, soft, unquote, to be available to work on such issues. And the same thing is true of economic history. But the economics department at that time, in 1963, as they did elsewhere in the U.S., had choices now for the first time. They were now able to hire young talent who were well-trained economists, who had had econometric training, had been through a core sequence in major universities, and yet still maintained interests in doing research in economic history and or development. And the department was anxious to replace the old-style development and the old-style economic history with the new, and they viewed me as one of such in this classification. Though, as I say, what I was doing was still not as high-tech as what they were doing. But Wisconsin had first always had a long interest in history. Part of it was the tradition of that economics department, with commons and all the rest, with a strong institutional lean. This just continued that tradition right within the department. And secondly, it had a strong interest in the third world. University of Wisconsin has always had an outreach program, or had previous to my arrival, which included the third world. For example, it had a sister relationship with the University of the Philippines, where there were economists going back and forth between the economics departments in the University of the Philippines and University of Wisconsin. There was other Asian interests that others had, like Red Hawkins and others that had a big impact on that department for a long time. Ted Morgan, Red Hawkins, Bob Baldwin, myself and others, Alan Kelly, were doing research on development, and even economists who now have no interest in development or little were encouraged to work on third world issues, like Bert Weisbrod, Lee Hansen, and others. So it was a very large share of the department was working on third world issues in the 1960s. It was a very popular field to be working on, very exciting field to be working in. And it spilled over into economic history, because economic historians found their interests in old industrial revolutions and old issues on growth, accumulation, and standard of living, and Malthusian questions reinforced by the contemporary interest in the third world. So I found it was obvious to me that the two were closely related, and as a result, I'd go for a period of teaching economic development, then I would tire of it and go for a period of teaching economic history, and researching one area and the other, bouncing back and forth, and I find I still do it. I find they're very much reinforcing, enrich my views of both.
Oh, actually, I stopped you in midstream.
I think I was at the end of my stream.
Well, what about the history?
Well, let me tell you how kind of my career at Wisconsin evolved, and then I'll flesh out what role economic history and the economic history program and my friends there played. I was there as an assistant professor from 63, promoted to tenure in 68, but prior to that went on leave to the University of the Philippines. I mentioned that Wisconsin and the University of the Philippines had a sister school relationship. Went to the University of the Philippines in 67 and, or was it, yeah, 67 and a portion of 68. Where I was very involved in teaching third world students and doing research on Asian economies. And so during that period, I was doing entirely third world research and teaching. Came back to Wisconsin in 68 and was there for four more years before getting another leave. So it's the end of the 1960s, the beginning of the 1970s, an incredibly exciting period on Wisconsin's campus, as it was everywhere else. We can talk about that more later, but it was, I think, the most exciting period of my life in terms of dealing with student issues. And at that time, still third world issues were very much still front stage in debate and research in Wisconsin, and it was exciting to be involved in that. In 1972, I went on leave for one semester. I came here to Harvard teach Hollis Chenery's courses. He was now had left Stanford, had come to Harvard, had then gone to the World Bank to become vice president, which he did for a decade. And as a result, there were people coming in taking his place. So I spent the spring of 1972 here at Harvard, getting a feel of it. Then went back to
Wisconsin. You didn't like it very well.
I didn't, as a matter of fact. I didn't like it at all. And part of it was Harvard, part of it was me, I guess. Part of it was being a temporary visitor, being here only a short period. Part of it, I was located not in this building where most of the economists are, but what is called 1737 Cambridge, which is a 5-minute walk away where most of the development people are still today. But then this department was physically cut up into two separate buildings, and as a result, if you were in the other building, you felt kind of out of it, which I did. That, plus being a tourist coming in only for a semester, didn't help integrate me in the department, so I didn't like it very much. I also found that the contrast between Wisconsin and Harvard was just so great, I found it hard to adjust. Here was a period of Wisconsin showing its greatest strength as an elastic institution responding to pressure on it, with lively, intensive public debate and responding to South Asian, Vietnam-related problems. Students forcing us to make decisions and to take stands. The university trying to respond to the students' pressure and watching that institution bend in the wind and adjust to it. I was really impressed at the way that institution was responsive to an incredibly difficult time. I was impressed at kind of the egalitarian feel. One, you can't spend 20 years at the University of Wisconsin without having it influence you forever. And I just found walking away from that place, feeling the sense of egalitarianism and lively openness in exchange on that campus, and then walking onto the Harvard campus, which is the other extreme, or certainly was then, still is, but not as great, in that it's very elitist, that the students are very distant, or were very distant from professors. Assistant professors, very distant from full professors, very hierarchical, with well-structured pecking order, and not much open debate. And I found that repulsive, and that's one of the reasons why I disliked it, disliked that state so much. So in part it was being a visitor who was here only too short to make it worthwhile to integrate. Second was physically separated from the main core by being in a separate building. And third was having a reaction to the Harvard elitism that I just found extremely difficult to deal with after coming away from Wisconsin. Things have changed a bit, I guess. But anyway, I left Harvard. I went back to Wisconsin at the end of that semester, and was back again teaching in Wisconsin for 4 years until going on leave in 76-77, where I went to Stanford to spend the year doing research. Then went back again to Wisconsin for
the, at this, the,
the centers?
No, not the Center for Behavioral Studies, but rather at National Bureau of Economic Research, which is only 50 yards down the hill. But it was nice for me because it was going home, and I love that part of the world anyway, so it was a marvelous year that Nancy and I had out there. Then went back to Wisconsin from 77 to 81, when another 4 years, and then back on leave again. My rotation seems to be every fourth year. And in that case, I spent the year at the World Bank in Washington, doing, in this case, development-related research for a year. Then went back to Wisconsin for one final year before coming here to Harvard. I was given the offer to come to Harvard in the spring of the tail end of that year at the World Bank in 1982. I made the decision, postponed the decision until I went back to Wisconsin and made it the following year. So it was 82, 83 that I decided to go to Harvard and then left in 83. So since I've been here going on my third year. Lots of things happened in that department and on Wisconsin's campus after the early 70s. And it very much changed its, I found, kind of changed its personality a great deal. Part of it was me getting older, but part of it was the department evolving over time. But through that whole period, whether starting with 1963, whether my current interest happened to be in the Third World or happened to be economic history, I found that the economic history group there at Wisconsin was one of the finest in America, unusual collection of economic historians, producing an unusual wave of students, high-quality students, with lots of lively interaction between the historians down the hill and the economists up the hill, which was, I haven't seen really replicated anywhere else. And it didn't survive at Wisconsin either. I'm not sure why. But it was an unusual period of 10 or 15 years from the early 60s through the mid-late 70s where the economic history center at Wisconsin was extraordinary.
So it survived the departure of Rondo Kenlon and Derek Lampart?
Yes, it did. In fact, I think it could be argued that it got stronger. Presumably, had Rondo and Eric stayed, it would have been even more strong. But let me just list the people. Are we at the end of this tape? So, here are the people that we had there. In 1963, Elizabeth Brandeis was still teaching, but not actively involved in the research program. So it was Rondo Cameron, myself, Eric Lampard, and Morton Rothstein. I hope I haven't forgotten anybody. But I think that was the group. Rondo departs, when was it, 1970, 71? Was it earlier than that, 68, 69? But right in the midst of the student discontent, and went to Emory, where he is still now. Eric Lampard left, I guess it was, in fact, before that, and went to Stony Brook, where he is still now.
Left out of discontent, or was it just that they had better offers?
As far as I know, Eric left. He still has very fond feelings about Wisconsin. Saw him just 2 months ago, where he reiterated it. He left because he wanted to go closer to New York, I think primarily because of his wife, whose name is?
Marie.
And also, I think Stony Brook offered a very strong inducement to Eric. But I get no sense that there was something pushing him away. In the case of Rondo, it was quite clearly something pushing him away. Rondo was one of the faculty members who had difficulty dealing with the student unrest. He really couldn't stand to have his authority challenged, and that is a bad time to be at the University of Wisconsin, because everybody's authority was being challenged, and some dealt with it, and some didn't. And he didn't. In fact, there was a violent fracas that triggered his departure with students trying to cross a picket line in front of the Social Science Building, as I remember. An unnecessary fracas that Rondo precipitated. But anyway, he left for a more bucolic environment where the students were less restive. There were additions, though, after their departure. There was Claudia Golden, who is now at Penn, who was with us there at Wisconsin for 2 years, I guess, before she left as an assistant professor. There was Nathan Rosenberg.
Were you recruiting those people?
The department was recruiting, and Nathan.
You personally, did you have to recruit them?
Not too much, because at that point I was still a very new associate professor and wasn't that actively involved in the politics of the department at that time. So no, I wasn't directly involved in that. But there was, I was more involved a little later with the acquisition of Peter Lindert, who is a fresh PhD from Cornell, whose interest was trade and history. He is now at Davis, where Morton Rothstein is, and has become absolutely very visible, outstanding economic historian. So at one time, we have Peter Lindert, Claudia Golden. Alan Kelly was doing research with me at that time on Japan, myself, Nathan Rosenberg doing all this technological history. Extraordinary collection of people. They departed. Nate Rosenberg left because Stanford called. I don't think it was push. I think it was just the pull of Stanford. Claudia Golden left and went to Princeton. Again, pull of Princeton and not the push of Wisconsin, I think. Peter Lindert left and went to Davis. That was much later. That's now 1975-6. A serious loss, I think, to the department. The department didn't think so at the time. And there, too, I think it was both push and pull. He felt that he wasn't appreciated as much as he thought he might be appreciated elsewhere. And Davis appreciated, and off he went. And pretty soon, it's basically down to Jeff Williamson in the economics department, which is extraordinary, coming down from a group of about five to a group of one over a period of 6 or 7 years. But on the other hand, the history department gets stronger in economic history. Morton Rothstein is still there. We're talking now about the mid-late 70s. Diane Lindstrom is a new addition, who is establishing herself. John Sharpless, with interests in demography and economic history, is new and developing. Some we lost. A serious one was David Herlihy, who is here now, in the early 70s, and came here to Harvard. So we lost a medievalist, but we retained Domenico Sella, who is still there. I keep saying we, you, who is still there, and so many others. So the history department was quite strong in economic history. But it began to, it seemed to me, it began to die. First, the historians in general were on hard times throughout the 70s as enrollment declined, and they all had to deal with austerity. And as a result, my friends in economic history found they had to teach harder and more often, and had to worry about what kinds of research they did and whether it would be relevant and saleable and so on. And that was interfering with kind of the intellectual life of the community, but still, the history department held up more of its share during that period of contraction than did the economics department with all those losses. So that basically takes us up to 1981-82. where Mort is still there, Diane Lindstrom is still there. Charles is still there. And Domenico is still there.
You got somebody else?
Of course I am. I'm forgetting Al Bogue. But Al Bogue's interest is, though he has obvious great visibility among American historians, became president of the association, but his interest in economic history dwindled and he got more interested in political history and doing quantitative work.
But he was part of your group earlier.
But earlier he was very much part of the group, interested in the American West, 19th century American West. So slowly this group evolves, and the quality of the debate dwindled, and by the early 80s, because of just sheer drop in numbers and contraction of resources, and it was a little less lively than it had been.
How had it acted? I mean, had it been a group? Were there meetings regularly?
Yes, there was. We had an economic history workshop that drew both the history department and the economics department. Two of us took main responsibility for it, that is, in setting up the schedule and getting speakers and so on. This would be every week we would meet.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
So this
was a weekly workshop. Students would present material, we would present material, and we would have visitors come in and present papers when we had enough funds to do it. Morton Rothstein took responsibility for the historians, and I would take responsibility for the economists, and since Morton and I were very close friends, we lived only a block away and raised our kids together, we communicated a lot. So there was, we met in the social science building most of the time, because most of the students were there in the economics department at that time, who were doing economic history. And also, as I recall, we had the funds to get outsiders, so we got to hold it there. But we did have it downhill once and again. The economic history group got these funds, but as I recall, it was more the effort of the economics department and me that
got
them.
University
funds first. We got one grant from the university to help bring outsiders.
Graduate school?
Yeah, it was a graduate school grant, as I recall. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was helpful, very helpful. It was a few thousand dollars.
Did you apply for yourself?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Do you remember who?
This was the late 70s, and I can't remember who made the award and who I dealt with. But that was part of it, and it was also true that the economists had National Science Foundation fellowship grants, and they would bootleg some of their funds to help support students, to help support the workshop, which would include, the workshop had a discussion paper series, which had a lovely red cover that you can still see some remnants of which on the floor. And I remember that... We had an office and a part-time secretary and discussion paper series and the workshop that met once a week and so on. And these, as I say, were financed primarily out of research grants that we all had, that the economists had, which gave us the advantage over the historians, of course, because they didn't have those grants. And then this one grant that came from the graduate school for a few thousand dollars for outsiders. So that was a way to pool funds to help the less fortunate in the group, among the staff, but especially the students, in helping facilitate their research. Now and I also failed to mention that the economic history group ran a journal out of the history and the economics departments called Explorations in Economic History, which Ralph Andriano, who I had forgotten to mention. Why? How could I leave Ralph out? As being instrumental in one of the key people in the Economic History Group in the late 60s. And he brought with him, when he came to Wisconsin, from Kent State Press, he brought with him this Explorations in Economic History, which he edited. And I took over, both Mort and I took over editing that journal for 3 or 4 years there at Wisconsin. Yeah, we got interrupted as I answered a phone call and dealt with a colleague who was calling from Stanford, who I'm bringing in for the Harvard Economic History Workshop next semester. And I just commented to Laura Smail how different things are at Harvard compared to Wisconsin in regards to resources. I've been here 2 years, and I'm still not gotten used to the fact that the resources are so abundant in this place. Well, we can have 13 visitors come in and visit every semester with funds in our workshop kitty and entertain them royally, whereas Wisconsin, we were lucky if we could have 3 and we had to put them up in our own houses. So it's just simply a difference in sheer endowment between the two. But what were we talking about before I got interrupted on that phone call?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the Explorations in Economic History. It sits up there in my shelf. It's alive and well. But as I recall, it had as editors at various times Ralph Andriano, Nate Rosenberg, Jeff Williamson, and Morton Rothstein. So there were 4 of us at one time or another were involved in that journal. It seemed like a good thing to move it on to another location, and it was taken up by other economic historians on the West Coast in the mid-70s, but there was a period of 7 or 8 years when that journal became one of the key voices of the so-called new economic history, and it was being edited right out of the economics and history departments at Wisconsin. In addition, Wisconsin hosted probably the most noted institution among the new economic historians, and that is the so-called Cleometrics Conference. Cleometrics Conference is a conference that meets every spring, and it has for 26 years. It's the 26th conference coming up, which is the longest history of an unbroken conference meeting, I think, in the annals of American experience, certainly in terms of NSF experience. It started at Purdue. It migrated from Purdue to Wisconsin. It went from Wisconsin after a bit to Iowa City, and went from Iowa City to Miami University of Ohio, and it's now gone up to Evanston and Northwestern. But this conference was a small group of about 40 or 45 invited to debate current research in the new economic history, intellectually as lively as any conference I've ever seen, and still is. The New Young Turks, it's those New Young Turks. Well, the Cleometrics Conference gives an Cleo, incidentally, is the muse of history. Metrics, of course, is measurement. So these are people who model and count in history. And these young modelers who do a lot of quantitative research would get together and fight over the issues of the day. And the fighting was intense and as lively as, I say, any I've seen. I've been to 2 or 3 of these things over the past few years, and I don't see any, I don't sense any diminution of liveliness. I mean, the issues are different, but the people are different, but the debates are just as lively.
Yeah.
Okay. So we therefore are describing an enterprise at Wisconsin, which is really unique. I mean, it had at its peak in the early 70s, five or six people in the economics department doing active research in economic history, almost an equal number in the history department, the two of them talking to each other, having an active workshop, presenting materials, at the same time hosting this Cleometric conference for 3 or 4 years, editing this journal, which has become one of the main voices for the new economic history. So all in all, I would describe it as one of three or four centers in economic history in the world. Its competitors being Chicago, where Bob Fogel was until he came here to Harvard. Second is Harvard, which at that time Gershenkron was running and producing just outstanding students. And the third was the Bay Area, Berkeley and Stanford, but they had not yet reached the level of eminence that they now have. Since then, Wisconsin has disappeared from the scene with all the resources leaving. And what's left are two big centers now, Harvard and Bay Area, Stanford and Berkeley, with Chicago, I think, kind of a distant third. Whereas before, Wisconsin was right up there with one of the top three centers in economic history. So it's extraordinary how much it changed over such a short period of time. Why did it happen? Part of it... Part of it was they left at a time when Wisconsin hit a period of severe austerity, and very few people were being replaced. Part of it's explained by the fact that economic history, certainly in times of austerity, is an extravagance. That economics departments have to worry about their main bread and butter, and their main bread and butter is theory and statistics, the core of the department. And so during austerity, it's the applied fields that are hit most heavily. So with each of these departures, the department was faced with, do we use the resources to replace what is already a rather, you know, big group of economic historians anyway, or do we allocate our resources to building up in other areas where we see deficiencies? And they chose the latter strategy, which is probably intelligent, until it got to a point where there was only Peter Lindert and myself left of the larger group. And when Peter Lindert left, then it got serious, and at that point, the department did try to hire a replacement, and the replacement we got was Carl Dahlman. Dahlman, who is a UCLA product with interests in medieval commons, agrarian commons arrangements. Didn't work out too well. He did not publish a great deal and didn't interact very well with the department, and so he failed to show promise for tenure, and he left. The department then did try, as you can see, to replace Lindert, but Lindert was hard to replace. Then when it came time to consider a replacement for Dahlman on his departure, by then the department was really having problems of austerity and financial crunch. We are now in the period 1980 to 1983, and there was almost no new hiring going on. And as a result, it was left with just me manning the courses and running the workshop. And it's impossible to run a subfield with just on a one-man show. Though there were still other people in the department with marginal interest in economic history who one way or another participated. David Granick would often come to the workshops. Ralph Andriano, though his interest became contemporary health issues, still maintained some interest in economic history. Jean Smolensky's interests in economic history had really almost totally died out with his interest in contemporary poverty, but he would still come now and again to workshops. So there were still people with interests in economic history, but there was not anyone else really doing research in economic history who could communicate that research interest to students and to interact with the rest of us.
Were you getting students? In
economic history, contrary to here at Harvard, economic history was not required in the curriculum in the economics department. Here at Harvard, it is. Two semesters are required to graduate students, which
is.
Is
it required?
No, on the contrary, it was in Rondo Cameron's era in the early 60s a requirement, as it was almost everywhere in America. The department voted it out, voted the requirement away. This was prior to my getting tenure, in fact. It was way back, 63, 64, or something like that.
You don't know why.
I think it was basically a reaction to a old curriculum and an attempt to try to revise the curriculum to stack up on students more of the modern theory and statistics and less on the old stuff, and so they eliminated what used to be old chestnuts like history of thought. And I think even now most departments feel it's old stuff, and that that it's an extravagance, and that students should be released from economic history requirements.
You said that it's a very exciting field.
Absolutely. I don't share that agreement. I don't share that view. I think it should be required of graduate students. I didn't have that feeling when I was at Wisconsin. I've picked that up since coming to Harvard. At Wisconsin, I and the rest of us had to compete for graduate students. Like any other applied field, and I think we did very successfully. The graduate courses I taught would have 15 students in them, and with each cohort of graduate students being say 50, that meant over a year you might get as much as 50 or 60% of a given cohort, which I thought was quite good.
Yeah.
Are you going to turn that thing off?
Yeah. Wait a second, I'll say that again. This is tape two of the interview with Jeff Williamson.
Okay. Now, where were we? We were... I've forgotten where we were. Where were we? Oh, yes. Why the demise of economic history? Yeah. The part of it was, as I tried to say, Wisconsin had an unusual collection of economic historians, and the department might well have viewed it as being, in some sense, too large. And so with the steady depletion of retirements and movements to other universities, they simply revealed that by not replacing. And I don't think any of the rest of us objected to that policy because we were a little embarrassed by the size of the group anyway, given other needs in the department. It was only when we approached the point when there was only two, or then just me, in the department that it became serious, because there was still a teaching load, there were still students there demanding the courses, there were still theses being written in economic history. It was not the most popular field. It isn't now, never will be the most popular field, shouldn't be, but it was strong enough to require educational resources tending to it. The students I had in my last years at Wisconsin were among the best I ever had. They were really outstanding, and some really first-rate theses emerged as a result. But the department faced the problem of replacing, when it got to Lindert and myself and Lindert's departure, replacing Lindert when they didn't have the funds to replace. When the department was faced with my offer from Harvard, where I could go to a place where there are many economic historians and lots of funds to run a workshop and so on, they were ill-equipped to compete.
They did try.
I was offered a research bundle to be used for any way I wanted to. I was assured that the department would hire a tenured person to work with me. But I do note that after I left, they have not replaced me, let alone added that extra person. And indeed, the economics department has not had an economic historian in residence since I left. So they've been 2 years without one. Though I hear tell that they've been busy at work trying to replace me. So far, they haven't met success, but they're trying to get a tenured person to replace me.
That was pretty short-sighted on their part, was it? Not to work when you still had critical mass?
I think so.
Keep something going, considering what an exciting program.
Yes, yeah. I think so. I think it was a great mistake. But on the other hand, part of the fault was theirs, part of the fault was mine, and others with interest in economic history. We probably didn't push hard enough for our view. We tended to be weren't assertive enough in pushing our view in terms of competing for claims on the department's resources.
Who was assertive?
Well, the economic historians and the econometricians and the theorists were very assertive in pushing for their priority. And it's awfully hard to argue against that position when those two fields are so central to all the other fields. It could be argued that economic history cannot be done with theory. It's harder to argue that theory cannot be done with economic history, and so it is with all the applied fields. Each of them tended to feel that, well, the priority should go to theory and econometrics, and those two fields pushed that that view very hard, with success. Probably it was for the long-term health of the department appropriate. But it was certainly not good to help give that department balance. And it's going to be extraordinarily hard for them to recapture anything like some portion of the position and eminence that they had in economic history again. Very hard.
Were places like the Poverty Institute and the IRRI and the Systems Research Center, did they siphon off energy that should have been put into central economics?
No, I would. In the case of the Poverty Institute, one could argue that they added resources rather than took away.
Because they got so much money.
Yeah, because they did get so much money, and indeed, they at various points they supported me very well. When I began to do work on American inequality, they were extraordinarily helpful in secretarial services and other modes of support. I have no complaint with that arrangement at all. The SSRI was not, that had evolved. During Guy Orcutt's period, it was big. By 1980, it was small. All it was simply an umbrella and didn't compete with anybody. So SSRI wasn't a competitor at all. It was just an umbrella that was convenient for researchers to use in the economics department.
Did you ever use it?
Yeah. The only way I used it was to pooling secretarial resources. When I would get a grant, I would buy a piece of a secretary that was in the SSRI pool, which was convenient. And in the 1960s, a large part of my working papers came out with an SSRI header on it, but I used it less and less as economic history itself developed its own resources for handling typing and processing and mailing of research output and working papers. The the Industrial Relations Research Institute was so distant, increasingly so, from the department, much to their unhappiness. That really wasn't an issue in terms of claiming resources and competing with departmental resources. So that wasn't, that really was never an issue in the evolution of economic history. There are other applied fields that that also had their problems. Economic history was not alone, though I think this is a dramatic case, but the other field which had problems was economic development, which also had 15 years ago an extraordinarily large number of people in the field. I was one of them. That was when I was, I had foot in each camp, economic history and development. And slowly the numbers eroded there, same tale, death, departure, and so on, and no replacement, till basically the courses were being taught by Sam Morley, who is now at Vanderbilt, and myself. And then Morley departed in the late 70s, and there we were. It was me. And I found it difficult because I was trying to handle both development and economic history and couldn't do it, and finally told the department I wouldn't do it, and gave up development, and just taught economic history and worked with students in economic history. And development, as a result, went for a number of years with courses only being offered spasmodically and so on. Now, it is true that that field generally went from a position of preeminence in the 1960s, when interest in the Third World was so extensive, slowly declined to marginal interest. So that it's now, in all departments, a modest field. But once again, it seemed to me that Wisconsin overshot, whereas other departments slowly reduced the size of, not economic history, we were unusual, but reduced the size of economic development to, a couple of men or women. In the case of Wisconsin, it once again overshot. It got down to zero, and then found it couldn't get it back up because it's extraordinarily hard once you fall below a threshold of a couple of people to regain. So there's another applied field that that underwent hard times, whereas here at Harvard, development is quite strong, not dominant, but. Strong. The labor economics had its problems with Glenn Kane on overload with theses, and although there are others teaching the area, like Lee Hansen and others, still the labor had become such a popular field that Kane and others were being really stretched out much too thin. So during this period of tension in the department with limited resources in the late 70s and early 80s, there are a lot of applied fields which had been really the heart of the economics department, disappeared or eroded to marginal impact. Those fields being development, labor, and economic history, and trade as well. Key applied fields, public finance is yet another. Wisconsin had always been famous for its applied fields. And here were economic history and development, two key ones, labor under attack, which were fast disappearing. And the department, I think, made a mistake to allow that to happen. The personality of the department has changed somewhat as a result. It's become much more theoretical and econometric as a result. And lost, I think, though I'm sure it's possible to regain it with some time and effort, what had been the outstanding feature of that department, which had been its very high quality commitment to applied relevance.
Is the whole department weakened because of the absence of these programs? That is, would students be less attracted to the university's program because they can't get these things?
Well, I think talking to my colleagues who are there now would get an your the answer probably would be different and maybe more accurate. But from the vantage point of here, looking there, I don't think Wisconsin can compete for the best students effectively by trying to do what the top four schools do. I think Wisconsin was unusually effective in getting, I think, students which were quite a bit better than in some sense they had any right to get. Indeed, it had a faculty which was quite a bit better than the University of Wisconsin really had a right to get in terms of, you know, total resources available. But one of the reasons they pulled it off was because of a special attraction of that university and of that department. It was a very friendly department. I'm sure it still is, but that was one of its attractions. A lot of intimacy and interaction and sharing of intellectual development, but also social as well. But also many very strong applied fields that interacted extensively. And that carried on a long tradition that dated back to John R. Commons and institutionalism, institutionalist school, with a long commitment to contemporary relevance in applied areas. That, I think, was its strength, and I think because of Wisconsin's interest in labor problems, in trade problems, development problems, economic history, and probably most foremost in recent years, poverty and inequality, that it attracted students who had those kinds of interests. And so it got unusually good students who happened to have those interests and came there for that reason. Wisconsin, I think, is less noted for those areas now. There are lots of other schools now that can offer good research and stimulating instruction and development problems. Wisconsin doesn't offer much. Certainly economic history. There are other areas now that can teach problems of income distribution. That Wisconsin, I think, has lost its leadership role in that area. And so the issue is, have they picked up enough in theory and econometrics to offset that change? And it's the econometrics group is as strong as any econometrics group in America. I can't say the same thing about theory. I don't think theory is as strong and competitive as the econometrics group is. So on net, I think they have lost. But was it the best strategy given that they faced budget constraints and you can't do everything? Now that, I don't know. I don't know.
Did you have anything to do with sociologists?
Well, I interacted some with them. They were in the same building, and the department was so outstanding, is so outstanding, that it was hard to avoid them. I talked, especially in recent years, as my interests moved in that direction, quite a bit to demographers. But generally, that is O.S. Sorensen, I got to know. He is now here at Harvard. But there are lots of others in the department that had quantitative interests, some with interests in income distribution problems, some with interests in demographic problems, who I interacted with a bit, not in a collaborative role, but we talked. Mm-hmm. You know, I found having a strong, or an unusually strong, sociology department close by advantageous for me. With my interest in interdisciplinary research, I found that to be a very, very potent attraction, which doesn't exist here at Harvard.
Well, it doesn't?
No.
Right, because they're not in the same building? Or
sociology department is inferior by by a day and a half, and also it's much smaller, and also it's distant. It's a long way away from this building. And whereas at Wisconsin, the sociology department is outstanding, some say the best, and right in the same building. So that was a great attraction, which doesn't exist here.
Did you ever use any of the resources, the services at the Center for Demography?
Yes, increasingly, is because my research interests got more and more involved in economic demography and historical demography. So I used their library, which is now on the fourth floor. I bugged Hal Winsboro about demographic problems. And some of their students took courses of mine, and I learned a bit more from them. So there, I did exploit the resources.
I asked that because I interviewed Hal Winsboro, and he said how difficult it was to get anybody from the economics department to use the center's computing resources.
I think that's true, and the computing resources, that's true. I never used that myself, because I wasn't interested in contemporary issues. I was interested in historical or third world issues and not contemporary American issues. And the database he had up on tape and spinning around on the fourth floor was primarily American data.
Oh, I see. And it wasn't a situation where you put in your own data?
No, it was more using the census tapes that he had been working with.
Did you obviously use computers.
Yes.
Did you have any problems getting enough computer time?
I never did. of course, I was supported by National Science Foundation, by grants that I went out and got. But in times when I was between grants, I found the university always to be very helpful for computer support. But in any case, I can compare Stanford, Harvard, Vanderbilt, and the World Bank with Wisconsin, and I would say Wisconsin's computer system is by far superior to all of those. It's far more user-friendly and far more accessible and easy to use and cheaper in the long run than any of the other places.
It says, did you use the 1100 or did you use the...
Well, there was an evolution in the systems over time, and I use all the mainframes that were available over time. And what was convenient is the social science building had there on the fourth floor the access, which I guess is probably not there anymore.
Maybe. No, it is.
Still there? Because Hal Winsboro, his empire was chewing away at that fourth floor computer center.
I think the Poverty Institute, I've forgotten the details, but it seems to me that when I was talking to Gene Spolansky, that they were about to get
Well, Winsboro actually got a computer, and he has got it there on the fourth floor.
Yeah.
And there was a kind of an imperialist fight over territory there, and crowded out the computer center that had been there at that time. But during my 20 years that I was there, I just found the computer system extraordinary. Of course, I had an advantage, too. I had a wife who's a computer programmer in the building. And so when I was having problems, which is often, and my students had problems, they could just go see her. And she would solve them for us. And most of the world didn't have that important resource handy and close by. But I just found the computer systems there fantastic. Much better than what we have here.
That's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, much better.
Considering Harvard
has money. Yeah. I was, I don't know whether this is the end of this thing, but I do recall about an hour ago saying something about you can't be at 20 years at the University of Wisconsin without it having carrying that tradition with you. And when I was at Wisconsin, I would meet people who had been there as students or had been there as staff members and would say the same thing, how much it had influenced their lives. and I still had very fond feelings about it. I've been here at Harvard for two, going on my third year. I like this place, I love it, and wouldn't change it for the world. It's just an extraordinary, lucky place for an academic to be. But on the other hand, I look back with longing fondness, a lot of attributes at Wisconsin that are painful to remember what I gave up, apart from friendships. The University of Wisconsin is an extraordinary institution. And being involved in it, and you do get the sense of being involved in it while you were there. Well, certainly I did during the growing phases of the 60s and dealing with problems. You don't come out of an institution like that where you feel like you're an active part of it and come to this one where you can see it's hard to change things without feeling some discontent and something missing. I also find that after being at an outstanding state university where egalitarianism and openness prevails, and where the focus is on upgrading the quality of human resources within the state and that local region, where it's so geared to the needs of that region and that state, and then coming to this place where it's geared to academic factory, they're different places, and you notice the difference for sure. And I miss it. I miss the sense of value added to undergraduates that I felt there. That one feels less here. You view the students more as being kind of like colleagues because they're all so damn bright and so well prepared. And your impact on them, you sometimes wonder. They could somehow, you sense that they could do it all themselves. You never felt that at Wisconsin. The sense of Midwest enthusiasm, which is so characteristic of Madison and the University of Wisconsin, uninhibited enthusiasm for topic, debate, social life, or whatever, is not a style at Harvard. The Harvard style is cool, laid back, and try not to exhibit too much enthusiasm for anything, because it's not cool.
Coolness is always favored over enthusiasm.
Yes.
Madison wouldn't thank you for that, well, particular characteristic.
Well, too bad. It's accurate, and I think it's a great strength, and should not breed embarrassment. That's what makes that place tick, the whole damn state tick, is total commitment and energetic, enthusiastic involvement. And it's got more people doing it than any other place in the world ever been. The university has more people involved in its functioning than this one. And that is a good thing. And I miss it. And as I say, I miss the egalitarian feel of it, where the distance between faculty and student is less, where the distance between tenured and non-tenured is less. And here the distances are huge.
It's interesting. It's obviously a matter of perspective, because of course in Madison all the students complain that there's a huge distance between them and the faculty and they never get to see them.
Well, that of course is a function of size, but that's all. That's maybe a lot, but that's all. Here it's style, it's not size. They have no excuse here, no size excuse. And I miss that, and I find that attitudes are very egalitarian, very elitist, and I am told it's nothing compared to what it used to be, but I find all my instincts when I sit on committee meetings and sit in faculty debates are, why is it that I completely disagree with everything that's being discussed here? Why is it I find myself disagreeing with the underlying premise of every debate? And I know why. It's because I can't get rid of the Wisconsin tradition. And I don't want to. So I hope I keep it, because it's a lesson that I learned and enjoyed and intend to carry it. So.
I gather you can't express, or if you do, it won't do any good, your disagreement here.
Well, and it's, I mean, one man or one woman, or even many men or many women are not going to change a long tradition that's even longer than the Wisconsin tradition. Three centuries is a long time, and this place has developed a style which is what it is, and is different. And Wisconsin has got something that Harvard will never have. The lucky Wisconsin. Too bad for Harvard.
Well,
I
think it's just a bad thing.